Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday, September 10th. 57 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Also, Heber City reporting 57 degrees. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, we are waking up to some nice weather conditions out there as we kick off our Tuesday morning. We've got those comfortable temperatures, but as we go throughout the day, we've got partly cloudy skies. Those partly cloudy skies will likely lead to some afternoon isolated showers and storms. Now, I don't think it's going to be a washout completely for the afternoon and evening hours, but I do actually think there's a decent chance of seeing some of those pop-up showers and storms, both in Park City and into the Heberhead Valley as we go throughout later this afternoon, and even a chance heading into the early evening hours. Now, before the rain chances arrive, looks like Park City will see temperatures climbing into the lower 80s for highs. In the Heber Valley, we're looking at highs into the upper 80s to right around 90 degrees as we go throughout this afternoon. Now, as we go into your Wednesday, we're going to see more changes heading our way as our big storm system begins to approach. That's actually going to mean drier conditions as we go into our Wednesday. I think we're looking at just partly cloudy skies. We may even see a little bit of smoke and haze coming in from some wildfires over Southern California as we go throughout the afternoon hours. But the bigger story will also be that dry air that's going to get pulled into the area as we go into your Wednesday with those strong winds out of the south and west, anywhere between 20 to 40 miles per hour. That's going to mean there's going to be some tough driving conditions on I-80 west and eastbound there. So keep two hands on the wheel if you're driving one of those profile vehicles. But also keep in mind that we're also going to be looking at dry air moving in, which could mean an elevated fire concern. So fire concern, but mainly dry conditions as we go throughout your Wednesday with those strong winds. Now, Thursday, that's the big day. That's the day we've been counting down to, waiting for. It seems like forever, but that's right. Our fall front arrives as we get into your early Thursday morning. That'll come through bringing us some gusty winds out of the north and west. We'll have a chance of maybe an isolated shower or two in Park City and the Heber Valley, but the rain chances are not going to be the big story. It's going to be the wind coming in behind that front and the much cooler air. That's right. We're talking in Park City, temperatures likely staying in the low to mid 60s in Park City as we go throughout your Thursday afternoon. And in the Heber Valley, we're talking highs only in the upper 60s to right around 70 degrees. So a big change heading our way compared to what we're going to be dealing with over the next couple of days. By the time we get towards your Thursday and by the time we get into your Friday morning, we're talking lots of sunshine, but yes, we're talking low temperatures in the mid to upper 30s for Park City and in the Heber Valley as we get into your Friday morning. So if you have been saying, hey, I'm tired of the heat, I'm tired of the summer-like temperatures, well, guess what? We are going to see a big change coming in Thursday into Friday. Now, the good news with this is by the time we get towards your weekend, both Saturday and Sunday right now look sunny and moderating temperatures, but comfortable. We're talking lows in the 30s and 40s with highs in the 70s to right around 80 degrees for both your Saturday and Sunday. So, Leslie, we just got to get through the next couple of days of summer heat. And then, yes, the big fall change finally arrives.
Okay. Thank you, Cedric.
Thank you.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the KPCW Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Transportation Manager Carl Lewis. We'll be getting an update on the Kimball Junction EIS study, as well as work on State Route 32. Park City resident Rob Lee in to talk about his successful swim across the North Channel and what's next. Finally, CEO of People's Health Clinic, Mari Lining, discussing the area's uninsured workforce and how the clinic serves as the safety net for them. Taking a look at some local news now, the Summit County Sheriff's Office says it is seeing a, quote, enormous increase in kids riding e-bikes recklessly. But enforcement is easier said than done. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more about that.
Summit County Sheriff's Office spokesperson Sergeant Skyler Talbot says deputies are receiving more and more reports of kids speeding or driving their e-bikes recklessly.
We've kind of come up against, okay, well, this is a difficult thing for deputies to enforce. You know, we're certainly not going to, you know, chase kids through parking lots. That's just going to increase the, you know, the danger.
So Talbot says they're educating parents and their children about the law. And it's not because they don't want to see kids getting outdoors or having fun.
What we don't want to see is kids getting hurt. And our fear, and I think a fear that's shared by a lot of the community, is that one day we're going to have a kid very badly injured or tragically killed on an e-bike.
That's a concern shared by local governments after three Wasatch High School students on an e-bike collided with a car and were hospitalized. Midway is weighing restrictions and Oakley is considering classifying certain e-bikes as motor vehicles. Park City and Summit County passed 15-mile-an-hour speed limits on some trails. Utah law recognizes just three narrowly defined classes of e-bike. Class 1 e-bikes are pedal-assisted but without a throttle, and they reach 20 miles an hour. Class 2 are pedal-assisted with a throttle and reach 20 miles an hour as well. Class 3 e-bikes are pedal-assisted with no throttle and reach 28 miles an hour. Helmets are required for anyone under the age of 21 riding a Class 3. Anyone under 16 can't operate a Class 3, and anyone under 14 needs to be with a parent. Anyone under the age of 8 cannot operate any class of e-bike in public. State law is mostly silent, though, on e-bikes that don't conform to those three classes. A new law that took effect in May says out-of-class e-bikes sold in Utah must have a sticker that says they are not e-bikes. It stops short of formally defining them as motor vehicles. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Updates to UDOT's plans for relieving the traffic gridlock at Kimball Junction were recently presented to the Summit County Council. In the studio with details, I have Summit County Transportation Planner Carl Miller. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. So at some point we had, I think, five alternatives to provide some intersection improvements. I think we're down to now two, alternatives A and C. So is this it? Just these two finalists?
Yeah, actually, starting several years ago, we had over 30 alternatives. We really wanted to cast a wide net, look at a lot of different options, narrowed that down over time to three options that we had. Alternative A, which was the split diamond alternative, which would provide an interchange west of Kimball Junction to bring traffic off of that closer to the outlet mall. That's moving forward. Alternative B, which I call the fly under, which would have provided a way to go through Ute and Olympic interchanges without having to stop. That did not meet the screening criteria that UDOT and the community set up. And so that will not move forward in the process. And then finally, alternative C is more of a traditional widening of 224, but also some pedestrian improvement and some intersection improvements. That also will move forward with the process. So we're really looking at that alternative A, the split diamond, and alternative C, the road widening. We worked with UDOT on a few different alternatives to alternative B, the fly under, and we just couldn't find a way that met all the screening criteria that we'd set up.
Yeah. So the council prefers alternative C, which again provides those intersection improvements and pedestrian improvements. You believe that there are some advantages to A, again, which provides that extra exit off of the I-80 there at Landmark. I think C is also, what, twice the amount as alternative A?
So alternative A would be a little over $100 million. Alternative B was looking at over $200 million, and alternative C is actually only $40 million. So there's actually quite a bit of cost savings with alternative C. Alternative A and C obviously do very different things. They both have their advantages and disadvantages. So alternative A would provide more redundancy, so you'd have multiple accesses to the interstate. But on the flip side of that, the downside is that really it would bring a lot of traffic through Landmark. And so it really wouldn't make that a very livable or walkable community. So while they both do different things, they do it in different ways.
Yeah. So is there a way to design, though, a Landmark Drive exit that would only funnel motorists into a future Kimball Junction Transit Center or park and ride?
There is ways that we can design Landmark Drive, and we're looking at that. That is part of our long-range transportation plan to upgrade Landmark Drive. Really, the key is how do we bring in additional vehicles and still make it a livable, walkable, something that can be comfortable for pedestrians and bicycles to go by. And so we're looking at a lot of different designs at this point, but we don't have a clear alternative for Landmark Drive and how to really bridge that into Kimball Junction, SR-224, and all the other things that could be happening in that area.
Yeah, so I guess I just don't see anything new here. I mean, it seems like we're still planning for, you know, the ways that we used to plan for traffic and circulation that we did, 30 years ago, and it's for the vehicle. How is this new and innovative and taking into account that, you know what, we have a lot of people riding e-bikes and people wanting to live in walkable communities.
Yeah, we really see Kimball Junction as a town center, not just a place to move traffic through as quickly as that we can. So we really want to make sure that Kimball Junction, as it evolves and with whatever transportation infrastructure goes in there, is really considering not just people that want to get through that, but also people that want to live there. And so a key aspect of the Kimball Junction interchange will be, how do we provide a community input and amenities and really bridge the gap between both sides of the state route 224. We're looking at, you know, different ways that we can provide community areas where people can gather, as well as a really more of a interesting complementary pedestrian overpass at that location than what we've done just with the at-grade crossings.
Yeah, but then when we talk about alternative C, where we're talking about, well, let's just widen it, right? Let's just put more cars on it. I mean, that's what we've always done. And I mean, some of us remember what 224 used to look like, right? I mean, if we hadn't done anything, maybe we wouldn't have this problem.
Well, Kimball Junction is really the gateway for the world to come into Park City. And so it deals with a lot of traffic, and it deals with a lot of access to our area. And so we're really looking at finding balance for those things. The pedestrian overpass really can go above and over the traffic, and really can be a place where people don't have to deal with walking directly next to high volumes and high speeds. So unfortunately, with a state route like this, it has to serve a lot of different things. One, moving people through, but also moving people around within the area.
So that pedestrian overpass, I think both you and the county council agree that would work well. However, I don't think it's convinced.
Yeah, unfortunately, when UDOT looked at the pedestrian overpass, it didn't meet the screening criteria, because it would actually cause longer walk times between the west side and the east side and vice versa. And so they would like to pursue a pedestrian underpass, a tunnel at that location. I, with this being the gateway to the community, we really don't see that as a feasible option. And so we're looking at ways that we can work with UDOT on still maintaining the pedestrian overpass and really beautifying that, making that a core central amenity for the area, where it really bridges the two sides of the community.
Yeah, so, I mean, would we see something like we see in Vegas? I mean, you'd need to have an elevator for that overpass?
It could be. We're looking at a couple different options, and we haven't ruled out how that will look. And we really want to make sure that we get community input on what they're looking for, and really making sure that this is safe, comfortable, and really beautifies the area rather than just adds more vehicles to it.
All right. So are you in the room with those discussions with Dakota Pacific Real Estate about the future of the Kimball Junction Transit Center?
There's a lot of conversations about that. I provide some transportation input.
And that's all you're going to say about it?
I think we have a really good opportunity to look at what Kimball Junction Town Center could be. And this could be a really important piece to that if we do it correctly.
Yeah. So is Dakota Pacific then able to lend a hand financially with either of these alternatives?
We're just working with UDOT right now, and it depends on what alternative we come up with. There could be a lot of different options.
All right. And then because we're headed that way with the bus rapid transit lanes, how will those fit into UDOT's alternatives?
Yeah, that's been a key aspect of this from the beginning. One of the screening criteria that we came up with was, what will this do to the headways for the bus rapid transit? And so both alternative A and alternative C both satisfy the needs that we have to make sure that those transit connections are frequent and fast, and that we don't delay the bus system with any kind of construction, that post-construction that we have on those routes. So that is a key aspect to this.
Yeah. So when do those get built?
We are currently in the process of design on the bus rapid transit right now. The design should be completed by the end of 2025. And then I believe construction can be done by the end of 2027. High Valley Transit obviously would have better details on the exact dates than I would.
Okay. does UDOT pay for those lanes, or is that something that Summit County High Valley Transit still on the hook for?
On the bus rapid transit lanes, that's a negotiation between High Valley Transit and UDOT.
All right. And also wanted to bring up, when we talk about a transit center, has the county even begun looking at what a future one might look like? I mean, is it something like we have there today with basically just some shelter and restrooms, or is it something more impressive like what the city of Boise has? I don't know if you've visited that, where we're talking about, you know, undergrounding a lot with bike lockers and such, things like that.
Yeah, I am familiar with the Boise system. And I know that when High Valley Transit and UDOT and all the stakeholders work together, we're really going to make sure that this is a multimodal and functional system, so that way it's really a place that you feel comfortable picking up a frequent bus and really have access to really the rest of the region based on this location. So that is something that High Valley is working really closely on, and I don't know if I have much more to details than they would on that.
So why is that High Valley's deal and not, isn't High Valley part of Summit County?
Well, we're certainly working together. They're taking the lead on that, as obviously they know exactly what their system will need, what the routes will look like, and what their drivers and their customers need as far as waiting areas and comfortable places to be. So they really are the experts on that. And while we're providing the supporting role, we really defer to them on that one.
All right, let's move on to the State Route 32 corridor study, a study of Southern Summit County where Route 32 is basically every town's main street. So what kind of problems or challenges does that pose?
Yeah, exactly. You hit it on the head. It's really one of those traditional highways as a main street situation where it functions as a state route, and yet so we need to move traffic through and giving access to the national forests and throughout the community. And yet this is also the heart and soul of these three cities in South Summit. And so they really want to make sure that this is not an area that people are driving quickly through and sometimes dangerously, but really it's a place that people want to congregate and shop and can be really be a place where we have you know, that traditional main street where people want to be there. And so we were lucky enough to get a grant from the Mountain Land Association of Governments, along with some local match from those communities as well as Summit County, to really take a look at a corridors and city centers plan on that. And that will really look at how are we going to look at both the transportation, the land uses, and economic development to make sure that from a corridor-wide situation, it's working, but also at a local situation, so the community can really have a place that they're proud of and provides a strong core for their communities. So we're really just starting to kick that off right now. We're going to be doing a lot of outreach with South Summit communities and really looking to engage with the citizens out there to make sure that they really get a say in how their future of their communities look.
Yeah. Well, and here's a good example. I mean, so what lessons does US 40 through Heber City teach us as we start to plan SR 32?
Yeah, that's a great question. And really, I think what we're going to want to hear is from the community is what do they want to see the same and different from that. I don't know if we'll have the ability to, I guess we're not ruling out anything at this point, but we really want to make sure that as we move vehicles through the community, it's safe and it's comfortable and it's not a place that really pushes people away from, you know, hanging out and being part of their downtowns.
Yeah. One of the lessons that I recall from Heber City, though, 30 years ago when we first started talking about a bypass and when the city started acquiring and the county started acquiring right away, Heber City residents didn't want a bypass. Well, you know what? They blew it. Because there is no bypass, and now it's just they've just made everything so difficult. So I don't know. It's like, who do you listen to? I mean, you listen to the future of, you know, vehicles coming through your community, or do you listen to the residents and do nothing?
Yeah, and I think it'll be a really interesting balancing act that we need to do, because certainly vehicles will need to get through the community, get access to the national parks and forests and everything like that. And yet at the same time, you know, make sure that this is a place that people, this is where people live. And so I'm not going to come with answers right away because I really want to hear from the community and see what they have to say. This could be something where we mitigate traffic behaviors in certain areas or avoid the situation by providing different travel patterns altogether. Really early in the process, and so I think what I would like to say is that we really want to hear from the community through that, and we're going to have some workshops coming up later, probably early in 2025, to hear from the community on that.
Yeah. So, do we try to codify that in a way so that as it comes through towns, that there is some similar setbacks and similar zoning, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's a great question too, is how do we balance, each of those communities are very individual. They have their own personal feel to them. And yet we need to have a consistent corridor that works all the way through. And so that'll be another good question is how much do we codify as a corridor wide, and how much do we enable each individual communities to really speak to their own desires and goals and objectives there. And so again, it will be a balancing act, and that's exactly why we need the community to come out to these outreaches. They haven't been scheduled yet, but when we do, we really want to make sure that we're hearing from the communities and finding out what are the unique aspects of each one that people really value.
What's the progress on that bike path that's supposed to run the length of State Route 32 from Francis to Oakley?
Yeah, we're working right now on that. We have some environmental mitigation that we have to do, and so we're looking at options on that. We really are hoping to get phase two and phase three under construction next year.
All right, and real quick on that 248 kind of traffic, we've seen some backups coming west onto 248 there at US 40 to move the old Highway 40 frontage road intersection. When does that project wrap up?
That's a great question. I and our engineering staff has taken the lead on that one, and so I don't have an exact date for you on that. I'd have to check with them. I know they're doing a really good job in trying to get that wrapped up as much as possible, as well as the Silver Summit interchange that we're looking to wrap up this fall as well. So those both have gone really quickly based on our public works team.
So they're at the Silver Summit. Does the traffic light go away once that roundabout's built?
It will. Yeah, we won't need the traffic light. The roundabout should sufficiently handle traffic, at least on that side of the corridor.
Okay. This is, I believe, the first full year of Summit County running e-bike share there in the Snyderville Basin. How much longer does the season last?
It'll really be to be determined based on what weather we have and what ridership we have. We'll probably shut it down towards the end of October. That's what we did last year. We had a really successful season last year. As you pointed out, it really wasn't a full season. We had to take on the bike share after our service provider went bankrupt. But I really want to highlight that was a success because our council had the foresight to bring on a lot of the operations team and staff. And so we were able to be responsive to that. We brought on an operations team that really hit the ground running and was able to really learn the bikes and the stations, and really provided a shortened season, but a successful season nevertheless. And then we have really good sponsors that have really could have walked away and said, it's not worth our time. And so Intermountain Health and Park City Chamber and Deer Valley all have sponsored the program even through a turbulent 2023. And now we've had a really successful 2024 that we have some beautiful weather. And so I'm really excited about that and encouraging people to get on those bikes.
So you were offering discounted helmets. Is that still offer available?
That offer is available. Yeah, we were able to contract with a helmet provider. We're really hoping to make sure that the bike share is a safe system. So this is the first time and maybe the only helmet program offered through a bike share I'm not totally sure about that, but it is a new system that we're hoping to get some success on, working with bike shops to distribute those, as well as we'll bring bike shares to people with their memberships. We're hoping that we can get maybe a sponsor on that for next year so we can broaden that program even more and make sure that everybody goes out on the bikes as being safe.
So with those helmet and ride sales, have you been able to break even?
Yeah, we're having a really good season. At the end of the year, we'll look at our revenues and expenses. Last year, we, other than some one-time expenses, we completely broke even, which is fairly rare for a bike share system. And so, but like I said, we have great sponsors. We have a great community that loves to get outside and be on the bikes. And so we really have a great setup here, and we're really looking to broaden that in the future. Next season, we really hope to get this bike share into more of the neighborhoods and community. Right now, we see it, at least the way it was run previously, was a lot of more for an amenity that people can use as they're visiting the community. We'd really like to get that into neighborhoods and make this more of an option instead of taking your vehicle, jump on the bikes, ride for a few minutes for errands or to work or whatever. And so if there's neighborhoods or hosts that would like to sponsor a station or have a station, please let me know.
Okay. And of course, you've heard all the conversation about e-bike safety, especially with young children riding them. So what kind of e-bike does Summit County offer? A class?
We have the pedal assist. We also have the ability to set governors on that through our mapping system. So we do set lower speeds in certain areas where we think that there might be some dangerous locations. We are working with Basin Rec and the city to make sure that where we have areas that we really want to slow that down, we can set the pedal assist so it doesn't kick in there. Obviously, people can still pedal and go as fast as their little legs will take them, but that will be a really good way to make sure that we're working with the community to slow this where there are some problematic areas.
Okay. What's the minimum age to ride those?
It's 18 right now.
Oh, so kids under 18 aren't supposed to be riding those?
Yeah, that's correct. We're really looking at ways that we can potentially provide that for youth under the age of 18, but so far that's the rules.
Is it a liability thing?
Yes.
Okay. All right, Carl, anything else you want to mention?
No, thank you for having me on this on the air. Just really excited. We have so many things going on, especially in preparation for the Olympics, and looking forward to getting a lot of these projects done.
Okay, well, we'll bring you back when you have more on the meetings that will be scheduled with the communities.
Great, thank you.
Okay, Carl, thank you. Carl Miller is Summit County's transportation planner. Well, on August 29th, Park City resident Rob Lee made a successful swim across the North Channel from Ireland to Scotland in cold seawater filled with jellyfish, wearing nothing more than a Speedo, a swim cap, and a pair of goggles. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, congratulations. I think most people want to know why.
That is a good question, a question I ask myself during the hours and hours I'm swimming, but I've been a lifelong swimmer. I do love swimming, and I just love a big challenge. And so there is a group of swims called the Ocean's Seven, which is kind of like the Seven Summits. It's not necessarily one on each continent, but seven iconic swims around the world. And this was the fourth of the seven that I've swum, so I'm kind of ticking those off.
Okay. This is what, about 21 and a half miles long?
Yeah, about 21 plus miles.
All right. And how long did it take you?
Took 10 hours and 36 minutes, which was, I thought I was going to be more in the 13 to 15 hour range, to be completely honest. So I got some help with some swell and some wind at my back at the start. And I think I just tried to take that and use it as an advantage.
Yeah. The record is an hour less than that is all. So
yeah.
You did pretty well.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't have the greatest training block coming into this swim and into my Cook Strait swim earlier this year. I hadn't gotten COVID for 4 years, and then I got it in January, and then I got it again in August, and I had that dreaded Park City cough for a couple months this summer, so just didn't have the greatest training. That's why I thought I'd be a little bit slower, but when you're out there and you get a little advantage, you take advantage of it.
Right. So I guess You had mentioned on your social media feeds that you were anxious about the cold weather, the currents, the huge jellyfish, and then you managed to get stung, I think, in the first 10 minutes. How many more did you have to deal with?
Yeah, I got the first one in the first 10 minutes, another one about an hour in. I saw a lot of jellyfish in the middle part of the swim, but I was able to kind of get around them or swim over them. And then it was the last 2 to 3 hours that I couldn't tell you how many times I got stung. I was swimming against the current at the end, which was super, difficult and just demoralizing as you're swimming hard and you're almost there, but it takes so long to get those last couple of miles. And so I just put my head down and I didn't really worry about them. My crew saw them coming, and normally they would tell you to go around them or give you a heads up to kind of swim to one side, but we were swimming against this current such that I didn't want to get pushed back out to sea, so we didn't talk about it. We just kind of made a collective decision, just put my head down and swim, and so I got stung quite a few times.
And what's the deal with these lion mane jellyfish? They're big, or is it that they're more painful stings, or?
A little bit of both. I mean, they are known as the biggest jellyfish in the world. The top of the jellyfish can be up to 8 feet across the bell of it. I didn't see any that big. The biggest ones I saw were maybe 2 to 3 feet across. The tentacles can be very long. They can be over 100 feet long. Again, I didn't see that size of a jellyfish, but they pack a powerful punch as well. The toxicity of them, it hurts a little while you're swimming, but I was actually, the one advantage of the cold water is I think my body was almost kind of numb. So I felt them for sure, and it gave me a zing. But again, I was at the end of the swim and I just was kind of putting my head down. So it was more when I got out of the water that I really felt all the stings and my whole body just zinging. The night before the swim, I only got about 2 hours of sleep just because I was anxious and, nervous and whatnot. And so after the swim, you would think I would want to go to bed and fall asleep right away. But I wasn't able to fall asleep until probably 4 a.m. that next night, just because my whole body was zinging from these jellyfish stings. And they do put people in the hospital with the kind of a toxicity.
Oh, man. Well, as I mentioned, you had a Speedo, a swim cap and goggles. You're not able to wear a lightweight wetsuit? I mean, are there some rules?
Anybody could go out and swim this channel or another channel with a wetsuit and call it a great swim. But to be recognized by the local and federal, worldwide federations, you have to swim kind of by the old rules, how people used to do this before wetsuits were invented only 70 years ago. So you really only get to wear a Speedo cap and goggles.
So the swim is regarded as one of the most difficult sea swims in the world. Do you have something harder coming up in the three you have left?
Yeah, of the seven, this was definitely considered the hardest, so I'm very glad to have it behind me. I've also got the Molokai Channel coming up, and that one is a warm water swim, so it doesn't have that crux, but it has a lot of others. The seas between Molokai and Oahu can be very rough. It's also the longest one. That one will probably be 30 miles or maybe more. That one will probably take me 15 plus hours as well. And that one does have sharks in it. Most of the swims I've done that hasn't been an issue. They've also got Portuguese man-o-war jellyfish and a lot of other factors. So that one is going to be a really difficult swim as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, you are burning a bunch of energy, especially when you're swimming across, currents and stuff like that. How is it that you maintain the feeding and the hydration that you need to keep going?
Everyone does it a little bit differently, but I stop every half hour. That's partly just even for a mental break to have a little human interaction with someone. But my feeds are pretty quick, so they just throw a water bottle, which is on a string, to me, and I've got hydration in there, but I've also got calories just in a drink mixture. And so most of my feeds are just a liquid feed, and I drink a water bottle an hour. That's got about 300 to 350 calories. And then if I get a little bit hungry, I'll substitute a little bit of food in there. So I think on this swim, I had 2 bananas as well. So I stop every half hour and they give that to me. I also probably drank half the ocean while I was out there just because of the rough seas. Not that that's going to hydrate me, but I definitely drank a lot of seawater on this one.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I've had a couple of times just in the ocean swimming salt water. I mean, what does it do to the inside of your mouth when you're in there for 10 and a half hours?
Yeah, my whole body when I get out is super swollen and just really worked. Also, just being in a horizontal position really messes with your body, your equilibrium, and getting out of the water into the boat. I had tons of cramps in my legs and stuff like that. The mouth, it feels funny, but it's not really a problem during the swim. But after about a day or two, my whole mouth kind of sheds a layer of skin because of all the salt water.
Jordanelle isn't the ocean, and I'm guessing that's where you do some of your long swims, or did you just practice in a pool?
The majority of my swimming ends up being in a pool, but definitely during the summer, I use Jordanelle and some of the other lakes, including Smith and Morehouse is a good one. No motorized boats on that one, so that one's nice. It's a little further drive away. It's also a little cooler, so for the cold water swims, that's a good one to swim in. It's also a beautiful lake.
Yeah, so I mean, how do you prepare for something like this?
I think you sign up and you buy the ticket, and that's the one thing I'd say about these challenges. People always ask me, you know, why do you do it or how do you do it or something like that. And like I said, I wasn't super confident going into this one, but I had already signed up and I had a ticket. And at the end of the day, you just have to kind of show up and get in the water and see how it goes. And that's what I've learned on these swims is you jump in the water, see how you feel, and give it your best shot.
Yeah. So do you have some kind of mantra as you swim? I mean, I guess what keeps your mind occupied? How do you convince yourself to keep going?
Yeah, I mean, every swim is different, but on this one, the mantra I usually tell myself when it's really tough is, I choose to do this, I get to do this, I'm able to do this, I'm going to do this, and I can kind of repeat that in cycles. And I just think about all the training that went into it, and it not necessarily even the last week or month or year, it's the years of training that went into each one of these, the fact that I traveled halfway around the world. On this one, I was thinking about my wife, Caroline, who is running for U.S. Senate, and how hard she is working, and she's doing that for 10 and a half months. And I thought, you know what, I can do this for, you know, 10 to 15 hours. So I just put my head down and kept going.
So you did have some photographers with you. Are you making a film of all seven swims?
Yeah, that's kind of the hope. Tommy Joyce out of Boulder, Colorado was with me, and he was mostly taking photos and video. He's also just obviously helping out as a crew member, but he's able to do kind of a short little video of each swim at this point, and then the goal would be at the end to put something longer together, something, you know, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes or maybe longer, we'll see.
Okay, so you mentioned Molokai. What's left to swim then?
You've got Molokai in Hawaii, the Strait of Gibraltar between Europe and Africa, of course, and then the Suguru Strait in Japan, which I actually did try last summer. They had implemented some new rules that made it virtually impossible. I was one of 12 swimmers that tried it last summer, and none of us made it with this new set of rules, and so they've kind of amended those rules. So I'm hoping to go back and do that maybe next year.
Yeah, how did it change?
They didn't want you to swim at night. They had an arbitrary line that you couldn't kind of cross, and I'm not really sure where that came from. They had a time limit, which kind of came out of nowhere. And so with the combination of those, it just made it impossible to make it.
Yeah. So you mentioned to me you kind of recovered from the swim, but then concussed yourself as you were...
Yeah.
While you were still over there.
Yeah. The... In only Rob Lee fashion here, the recovery has been quite interesting because the next morning I was so exhausted and kind of out of it. I was staying at just an Airbnb, and I was walking out of the Airbnb just to go get a cup of coffee and some breakfast, and I hit a low ceiling with my head, and I definitely saw the stars and all that kind of stuff. And I, you know, in the days after that, I just kind of felt off like you might after a big effort, but I was dizzy and just kind of foggy headed. And once I got back, Caroline finally convinced me to go see our doctor, Dr. Testa here, who's amazing. And he said, yeah, you definitely have a concussion here. So the recovery has been kind of in a fog. It's been a weird recovery.
Yeah. Have you been back out swimming?
Not yet. Yeah. Soon. I'm kind of waiting for the concussion symptoms to mostly go away, and they're mostly gone, but maybe this week or definitely next week I'll hop back in the water.
All right. So it looks like all of your swims are northern hemisphere. So are you kind of done for the season, or when would you?
The Hawaii swim can happen at any time for the most part. And so I was getting through this swim before I planned the other swims. So some of these swims take years to be on a waiting list and whatnot. I've been on the waiting list for Gibraltar since 2018, I believe. But I think my number will be called next year, I'm pretty sure. Molokai, I should be able to do, now that I'm kind of settling back in here, I'll probably give those guys a call and see when I want to attempt that. And then hopefully Suguru next year, next summer. So the hope would be in the next year I can do the next three.
Right. Well, good luck to you, Rob.
I appreciate it. Thanks
All
for
right.
having me in.
Thanks. That's Rob Lee again, who just successfully swam the North Channel. The People's Health Clinic is a volunteer-driven, community-supported clinic providing high-quality, no-cost health care to our uninsured residents of Summit and Wasatch Counties. In the studio with more, I have the clinic CEO, Mari Lining. Good morning, Mari.
Hi, Leslie. Thanks for having me here today.
Yeah, so I made note in the intro that this is a community-supported clinic through private donations and local grants. You don't take any state or federal funding.
Oh, we absolutely love state funding. Please send it our way. We do not take federal funding because we are not currently a federally qualified health center, which is a different designation. We're considered a free health clinic.
Okay, interesting. And what would have to change for you to take federal funding?
It's actually a large process where you meet certain requirements to become a federally qualified health center. That involves, you know, consultants and expansion of departments that we don't have currently at the People's Health Clinic, like billing, for example. As a free clinic, we have no billing department because we don't bill people. We see people entirely for free. If they want to make a contribution toward us, they can. Otherwise, healthcare is no cost.
So what are the numbers of folks that you're helping?
So in 2023, we provided over 13,000 patient encounters, and a patient encounter includes everything from provider visits to our case managers helping patients fill out Medicaid applications. This year, we've had a tremendous year, actually, with our Mackenzie Scott gift of $1 million. We expanded our evening hours 3 nights a week, and so I'm expecting us to have well over 14,000 patient encounters this year, with us servicing probably closer to 4,000 individuals. Wow. Last year, we saw over 3,000 individuals.
Okay. So none of these folks have insurance, but I'm guessing most of them work.
Correct. Almost all of our patients have one job. In fact, the majority work two jobs. They do not have health insurance for different reasons. Most of our patients are not legal residents in the United States, which means they are not able to qualify for government subsidies. So most of our patients live below the federal poverty level. And to put that in perspective, that's an individual living on less than $15,000 a year in Park City, despite working one or two jobs. They are not qualifying for Medicaid, not because of income level, but because of legal status. In fact, even if somebody has legal residency status, like, you know, it's been called a green card, you're still unable to apply for government subsidies in that first 5-year window. And that's really the bulk of the patients we see at the People's Health Clinic.
But again, many of these employees, I mean, if they don't have the legal status, are still working. Doesn't the employer have some sort of obligation to provide them insurance? I know it doesn't have to be free, but they've got to have some kind of insurance plan if they're over a certain number of employees.
So this is an excellent question and a complicated question to answer in that I need to tread lightly. Correct. All of our patients could potentially have health insurance if the people who paid them a wage decided to give them benefits. The reason why they are not held to standard employment law is because they are hired as contract workers. The way I best describe it is really like a set of Russian stacking dolls. So there's a corporate entity, let's say it's a hotel, and that hotel can hire workers through a third party. That third party then supplies a workforce as contracted hours. And the corporate entity doesn't really have further details, if that makes sense. Now, that third-party employer could absolutely offer benefits to our patient population, but they don't have to because of the nature of contract work. And a lot of this is really, cash under the table.
So that's what we see going on then. We know that's going on.
Correct. And that really has everything to do with why our patient population lives in poverty despite working full time. So an example of an individual I saw a year ago, he came into the clinic. He thought he actually had COVID. It turned out he had acute HIV, which he had contracted from a partner here in the United States. And I said, I need to get you down to the Ryan White Center at the University of Utah so you can get treatment immediately. His immune system was shot. And he said, well, I can't do that. I work for a hotel and my hours are 6:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, 6 days a week. There's no way I'm gonna get down to the University of Utah. So that's just an example of the employment situations that our patients are in. Why I'm talking about this from the standpoint of the health clinic is, you know, poverty has everything to do with health status. And it's very difficult for us to provide health care to individuals who, number one, are unable to physically show up in our clinic, but number two, are truly battling the social determinants of health, poverty being one of them. But this also includes, you know, housing, transportation, language barriers, health literacy levels. All of these different components contribute to our ability to be healthy. And the employment situation of our uninsured workforce here in town really negates our efforts to make sure that all community members are healthy.
Yeah, and kind of as we kind of pride ourselves on sustainable tourism and our equity and inclusion, it sounds like we're doing a pretty poor job when it comes to providing health care.
I think our community is unusual in that we have the People's Health Clinic, which is generously supported by private donors. We received very generous special service contracts from the city last year. So I think we have an unusually compassionate community that recognizes the importance of healthcare. But absolutely, I think we can do a better job. And in fact, you know, with the Olympics coming in 2034 and with us going on to the world stage and with recent initiatives like the sustainable tourism plan or the rollout of Mountainkind, I think it is really important for community leaders, for nonprofit leaders to come together at the table and ask ourselves, you know, how do we want to be as a, you know, or really who do we want to be as a community? How do we want to define ourselves?
Okay. You mentioned the $1 million grant that you received from Ms. Kenzie Scott's Giving Foundation. How are those extended hours working? It just sounds like you're seeing even more people.
Exactly. We're seeing more people. So we're open until 8 o'clock at night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we have providers there. And opening up these evening hours is really important for our patients who work in jobs that it's just not, again, possible for them to come in during daytime hours. When we look at, you know, the uninsured workforce we care for, we see about 30% cleaners. These could be individual house cleaners in your home or, you know, in resorts. We see about 30% restaurant workers and then 20% construction workers. So if you think about the schedules of those individuals, you can then imagine that it's hard to show up, you know, for a 10 a.m. Monday morning appointment.
Yeah. So are you, would you be able to reapply for that grant, or was it just kind of a one-time deal for you?
I believe that one was a one-time deal. So something that we're looking at really seriously as a leadership team on a board level at the People's Health Clinic is, what does sustainable funding look like for us, especially in this next decade of anticipated growth with the expansion of Deer Valley, you know, the addition of Marcella, the Olympics coming. At this point right now, we're doing the very best we can to keep wait times down for our patients to about 3 to 4 weeks. But as this population expands, how are we going to be able to meet the needs of this uninsured workforce without the support of the entire community?
Mm. Yeah, and that $75,000 grant that you received from Women's Giving Fund this year, again, that can be spent that quick.
Yeah, that we're really excited about. It's allowed us to hire a women's health program coordinator, community health worker, and that individual is actually going to start on Monday to pull our program together. In fact, I'm going to send our OBGYN, Dr. Tanya Bodner, your way in November to talk specifically about that program through the Women's Giving Fund grant.
Okay. But again, that was a one-time grant, so you'll need funding to continue that position in the future, right?
Yes. And that one is actually over 3 years to support this part-time position. But, you know, as a CEO of a nonprofit, at the end of December every year, I celebrate, you know, we made it, we raised the revenue we need to keep our doors open, and then January 1st, we start all over again. And so I think the larger question is, what does sustainable funding look like for a free clinic in a town that deeply depends on it? I mean, realistically, if our patient population, which again is this huge uninsured workforce, quit working tomorrow, our town would shut down. And so we need to do everything we can to keep our workforce healthy and supported and just, you know, ethically. We should care for all members of our community. As you brought up the point, you know, what does equity look like? Well, healthcare is a human right that was determined back in 1948. You know, while the United States doesn't have universal health care, I think Park City can achieve an understanding that all of our community members deserve that right.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Mari, thanks so much for your time.